I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Welcome to Democracy Sausage Extra. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU, and of course this podcast is a joint production of ANU and Policy Forum. I'm very glad today to be speaking to an old colleague of mine, Matthew Knott. He's the US correspondent now for the Nine newspapers, used to be the Fairfax papers, and Matthew and I used to work with each other in the Sydney Morning Herald Bureau, Sydney Morning Herald and Age bureaus in Parliament House in Canberra. Now, a few months ago, we also spoke to, on this program, another former colleague from then and who is now the UK correspondent, Bevan Shields. Now, Bevan's been covering the COVID outbreak, of course. He covered it in northern Italy when the outbreak was ravaging that part of Italy then, and obviously covered the calamitous handling of the COVID threat as it started to ravage Britain as well. And Bevan then succumbed to the bug himself, and he was able to give us a harrowing account of what it was like to have COVID-19, and it was not a pretty description. Now, I'm very glad to have Matthew not on the program today, as I say, former colleague, but Matthew might be able to even trump, if I can use that term, Bevan Shields' personal experience out on the road, because Matthew Knott has a harrowing tale of his own. Matthew Knott, welcome to Democracy Sausage Extra.
Hi, Mark. How are you? It's great to be having a chinwag with you again.
It is good to be talking again. It's extremely cold here in Canberra, so you probably remember that. Having been in the US winter, you'd know a bit about the cold, but I guess it's a fair bit warmer where you are in Washington, D.C.
Living here in summer, you realize why they call it the swamp. The humidity is really, really intense. It's not very pleasant, and there's no relief from any kind of breeze. So, yeah, I worked out where that nickname came from.
Yes, but of course it has its political dimensions as well.
Yes.
As Donald Trump has weaponized that whole idea. But look, it wasn't your story. Doesn't come from Washington D.C. This harrowing tale I refer to. It comes from New York, a little to the north of Washington. Tell us, if you will, what happened to you.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned about Bevan, because once it was clear I was alive, we did had a joke that I was just trying to outdo him for sympathy on social media and with our colleagues when I had my incident. A bit different. It doesn't have the same geopolitical implications as the coronavirus, although it is related. I went up to New York for a friend's birthday in June, kind of the first gathering of any type like that I'd been a part of in months because of social distancing in Central Park. Afterwards, We went back to his rooftop in New York of his apartment building, which is quite common to go up to the roof in New York, but particularly so during the pandemic for people to be out in the open air and, you know, not congregating inside. And then I was walking over to what I thought was another part of the roof. This is on the top of a 5-story building. And suddenly I was falling with nothing under me and smashed into the ground from that height. And
a 5-story plunge towards the concrete.
Yeah, off the rooftop. So it's 60 feet. I don't know what that is in meters. Yeah, with nothing stopping me. And so then was being taken to hospital and whatnot.
Were you conscious at that point?
Yes, I never lost consciousness. So I knew that I was alive, just in a lot of pain, a bit unclear what was going on. I knew something quite bad had happened. And then was taken to a big public hospital in New York, and all types of people looking at you, doing x-rays. And so I turned out the main things I had were a broken elbow and wrist, dislocated shoulder. The other shoulder was fractured, some fractures in the back, which sounds like a lot, and it was at that time, but the general consensus was really that it's a miracle that you're alive and that you, you haven't damaged your legs. You're still going to be able to walk. You haven't been concussed. You haven't done any damage to your face or neck or anything like that. No internal bleeding. So it was incredibly lucky. And I've looked a bit into the literature and the statistics about it. And it's really more than a 50% chance that I would have died from that height. So I feel lucky to be here talking to you.
Yeah, well, I feel very lucky that you are as well. Bevan actually was the one who rang me from London because, you know, in this COVID time, as you say, when all kinds of, basic things are more difficult, the people you were with were not sure how to get in touch with your next of kin and had met Bevan, the UK correspondent, and had his number and were able to contact him, and he was able to do some things in terms of informing your family and one or two others. Just tell us what your understanding is of how it happened, because I think up on those roofs they often have a low wall around the rooftop, and they're sort of tarred, so they're kind of matte black or very dark coloured. And you're up there at night and you think you're walking towards the edge, but there's in fact an edge in between you and the edge that you're looking at. And that's a little laneway or something.
Yeah, what some Americans call it is an air shaft, similar to the idea of a skylight. But really what it is just a very narrow gap, which is designed just to let in some light and some air into the building. Some cases in order so that, you know, you can sell it as a bedroom. It has to have a window. It's not really, that's the purpose that it's serving, is to just let a bit of light and ventilation into the apartment buildings. That's why it's there.
And I believe the first responders, the ambulance people who came to get you, made some observation that they're not normally taking away someone who's alive, who's plunged from a building at that height. That's normally a more maudlin task for them.
Yeah. I remember them doing various tests, asking what your name is and what the date is, and checking whether my legs could move and what could move. And I do remember, even in the fog of the pain and confusion of what was going on, them saying, "You need to buy a lottery ticket because we've been to similar sites like this and it hasn't ended so well." So I knew from pretty early on that I was lucky.
And it was pretty tough for your friends that you were with at the time, because of COVID, they were not able to go into the hospital at all with you and weren't able, because they weren't next of kin, weren't able to get information, as I understand it, about how you were progressing. So all around, just an extraordinary story, which does have its sort of COVID dimension, but as you say, is really just this remarkable story of luck and survival in a circumstance that you wouldn't think you would be able to survive.
Yeah, and I should also thank my father who came over from, had to get special approval to come over from Australia to kind of help me and, you know, cook and clean and help me get dressed. He's currently in 2 weeks of hotel quarantine, not being able to leave, now back in Australia. So I did appreciate that.
Yeah, isn't that great? Bevan told me also, I hope I'm not talking too much out of school here, but he told me also that when he was telling me about this at the time, that your main concern, and I have great admiration for this and for those of our profession, but your main concern was that you were desperate that you weren't repatriated to Australia because you were looking forward to covering the US election, and that's to which we will now turn our attention. But that's correct, is it, that was one of your major concerns?
Definitely, yeah. No, I wouldn't be keen to go back at all. The option didn't even cross my mind. I would try and stay here to do it, given how many years we've been waiting for this momentous election. Yeah, I wasn't keen to miss it at all.
Now, I know this interview so far is sounding pretty in-house, and there's even another in-house dimension to it, albeit tangentially, but one of the big issues, big developments in recent days in the US has been the interview that Jonathan Swan did with the president, President Donald Trump. Jonathan Swan's also a former bureau colleague of ours from the Sydney Morning Herald and Age bureaus in Parliament House a few years back. He's also the son of Norman Swan, as everyone or as many people are starting to now realise. How did you see that interview? I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. How big is it in the US?
It generated an enormous reaction here. I saw experienced journalists and commentators on Twitter, you know, describing it as the best interview of Trump they've seen during his presidency, which says a lot. What some people say is that it says a lot about perhaps how bad some American interviewing is compared to the Australian style. In general, I think the American style of interviewing is much more deferential and soft than what you would see Lee Sales or David Spears doing traditionally. That's not for everyone. Chris Wallace on Fox News actually did a really tough interview with Trump the other day in which he was talking about that cognitive test that he took where you have to identify an elephant. But Jonathan's really cut through in the way that he seemed to give Trump a lot of rope to hang himself with in terms of really parrying with him about these issues about the coronavirus and death counts and so much. It was the way he followed up and didn't just move on to the next question with Trump. He didn't let Trump just steamroll him with a blizzard of words that I think caught a lot of people's attention here and said, this is a very significant interview.
Do you think some of that was just the sort of power of being an outsider, that little bit of extra objectivity that comes with not being, as encultured and not being regarded as encultured in American culture, and therefore the president was perhaps more accommodating, or was he just caught off guard or caught on a bad day? Because he really did not perform well in that interview, and yet he didn't seem to lose his temper either, really.
No. Yeah, I think that does help. I find that there's a lot of goodwill towards Australians. People love the accent. They come with a good preconceptions about Australians, and that's a good thing that you can take advantage of as a journalist. Another thing is just that also Jonathan is regarded as very fair and balanced. The media here is, even more so than back home, is very polarized and people put in boxes of being left or right, and it's not like that with Jonathan. So I don't think that Trump felt he was coming under a partisan attack as he might with some other journalists.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true, and Jonathan has made a real name for himself in terms of his contacts inside the GOP and inside the administration, the Trump administration. He's trusted as a fair reporter and one who's very conscientious, so that's a credit to him. And I have to say, when we had him on the podcast a few months ago talking about American politics, I was just so impressed with the level of his analysis basis, but also the authority of it, the fact that it is so well sourced from those many contacts that he has on Capitol Hill and in the American political establishment. And I'd encourage any listeners to go back and have a listen to that podcast, because Jonathan is really the goods. Going to the substance of what came out in that interview, it's going to be interesting to see I'm interested in your opinion as to whether Trump now is technically cooked. I mean, is he able to win this election, do you think? Obviously, it's a two-horse race and, you know, no one's ever completely out of it, but it does seem to have taken a fairly decisive turn away from him on the back of this COVID crisis and its complete mishandling. What's your view about that? Is that just too blunt a question to be definitively answering at this stage?
I think so, to be completely definitive. First of all, just people are so scarred after the surprise of the last time that people in general are much more wary about making definitive predictions, given how few people thought Trump would win the last time. Then there is still a little bit of time to go, but the thing is that the window is closing for major changes and major developments. The pandemic has made politics much more stable compared to 2016, in which you had things like James Comey, the director of the FBI, releasing this letter about Hillary Clinton that generates all this attention, or Trump, the revelations about his comments about groping women, these big things. The coronavirus is so all-encompassing that politics as normal is struggling to break through, and Americans have had 5 or 6 months now, really, to observe the way the country has handled it and the way Trump has handled it as president. And many people have made up their minds that he hasn't handled it very well. It's still not under control on a national level. It's just been moving around the country, and that makes it difficult for him. What can he do to change that narrative? He's used to being able to control the news cycle, but it's hard to compete with the coronavirus for attention when it's affecting people's lives so dramatically. And even the voting system, with so many people wanting to vote by mail and vote early rather than wait in a line on November 3, some states, it's not long now until people are going to start voting. So that's going to limit the opportunities for Trump to change the dynamics here. So not going to say that he can't win, but it's looking very bad for him at the moment.
Let's take a quick break there and be back in a moment.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, just before the break, Matthew, you were saying that in some states, voters aren't that far off being able to cast their votes by mail. This is a political issue in itself. The president is reported today in Australia as threatening to sue the state of Nevada, I think it is, in an attempt to frustrate mail-in voting there. It's all part of I guess a cloud of comments that he's made recently that point to him quibbling with the result. First, how far off are we from voting, or are Americans, the first Americans, from voting in the election? Is it quite soon?
Yeah, it's incredibly complicated because it's different in each of the 50 states how people vote, when they can vote, which is part of what makes the system here so complicated. There's nothing like the Australian Electoral Commission, which is running things in a centralized way. Some states, yeah, some swing states like North Carolina, people will be starting to vote from next month. And traditionally, that hasn't been normal in America for people to vote early. I know in Australia, you know, it's been taking off more and more each year of people wanting to get it out of the way. But it's going to be a big change this year. And the question is, can the systems handle that? You know, many of these states don't have enough money at the best of times to run their elections very well. We've seen problems in the past. Remember the famous incidents in Florida with the hanging chads and the ballots not working. The question is whether some of these states are going to be up to processing a flood of mail-in ballots where they may not have done it before. So this is the tricky part, is that you do have real problems potentially, but rather than proposing really helpful ways to address that, Trump is seeking to sow a legitimacy about the results in the expectation that he may not win, and wants to have an excuse for why he didn't win.
Do you think it's possible in the context of that, is it conceivable at all that he might not run, that if he decides he's facing absolute humiliation, that he could pull out and say that he was the subject of a, you know, a conspiracy of the lamestream media, as he calls it, and the sort of left-wing radicals and everyone else, that everyone – it was just impossible for him to get a fair hearing? Is that just pie in the sky?
I've seen people say that. I think he's running out of time to do that, because later this month he's going to officially – except
be on the ballot,
the nomination. Yeah. They're talking about where to do that. I think the strategy isn't that. The strategy is that if he loses, he will say that it wasn't legitimate and be able to say potentially for the rest of time that he didn't really lose, that it was rigged, that it was a scam, and keep up that premise for his followers. I think that's the game plan. He wants to have it both ways. Obviously, if he wins, it will be legitimate. And if he loses, he'll be able to go on for the rest of time saying that it wasn't.
And as you say, if the states aren't particularly well experienced at handling large volumes of mail-in votes, and there's a lot of voting going on before polling day, it strikes me that with multiple systems and all of that new complexity, and we've seen the way governments respond to complexity through this COVID crisis, and nothing's absolutely faultless. It seems to me there's real potential there for things to go wrong, even with the best will in the world, and that will be grist to that mill of his. Mm. We saw in Australia, for example, you remember this, Matthew, when there were the problems with the WA missing ballot papers a few elections ago, it takes very little indeed to shake public confidence in the fair administration of an election. The Australian Electoral Commission, for example, has been really very, very professional for many years, and yet immediately that happened, there was speculation about its professionalism and the propensity for corruption to creep in and that sort of thing. This is a turbocharged version of that.
Completely. When you describe, I've described the AEC to people here, and they just cannot believe that you could have an organization like that that isn't politically tainted, you know, and that no one, ordinary person knows who's running the AEC. It just happens invisibly, which is a sign of how much confidence and trust people have in it. Well, here, it's politicians, elected officials themselves in each state running the system. So you couldn't get a bigger conflict of interest than that. So the moment that something goes wrong, or the moment that it's even close, you've got a lack of trust and so much motivation for the losing side to cast doubt on the results. And the thing is, if the result is coming in later because of these mail-in ballots, that creates more time for people to complain and launch legal action. You know, people are really getting prepared here for the possibility that there may not be a result on election night, which...
So those mail-in votes will be counted after polling day or on polling day and continuing thereafter, but potentially in different states and using possibly different methodologies for counting them.
It takes longer. Yeah, the thing is, places like California that use it, it takes weeks for their ballots to be counted. It doesn't usually get much attention because it's a safe Democratic state and the result is already known. But if that's happening more across the country, and if there's a big difference, Republicans are saying they want to vote in person and Democrats are saying they want to vote in mail, so vote by mail. So if you get the in-person votes first, it could look like Trump is winning when perhaps he's not, when the other votes are coming in slower. It's, I think there's real potential for a complete disaster. The thing that would stop that would be if it really is a landslide for one side or the other.
Yes, and that doesn't seem absolutely impossible from here. By how much is Joe Biden, the Democratic presumptive nominee, by how much is he leading Trump now in most of the polls that you're reading?
He's leading by about 7 or 8%. It's been, in terms of the averages, it's been bumping around a little bit. If anything, the big lead may be moderating a little bit, and that's what people would expect. I think everyone's expecting it to get at least a little bit closer to Election Day as Republicans come back to the party and stick with Trump. He's doing well in most of the key battleground states, but the thing is, it wouldn't take much of a tightening for Democrats to start getting nervous, both because of the way it went in 2016, some doubt still about how accurate the polls are, and just this issue of the Electoral College, the fact that no one really expects Trump to win the most votes on the national level, but could he somehow squeak out a very narrow victory again, or even more narrow than last time in some of these states? So if the polls are coming into 3% or so in these states, the narrative's going to shift pretty quickly.
And that may be to the Democrats' advantage. One of the problems that you have, particularly in a system where you have voluntary voting, you have a problem when it looks like the result is preordained, that it's inevitable, and sometimes your own supporters don't come out and vote for you because they figure you're going to win anyway and they don't need to. It's almost in the Democrats' interest to at least have this thing remain close, particularly if they have the analysis that, and the evidence seems to point to this, that if everyone voted, the Democrats would win at the moment. That I mean, I'll be interested in your response to this, but my theory for some time has been that Trump hasn't particularly broadened his base since being president. He may have made them more passionate in some cases, but he hasn't particularly broadened it, whereas he has been very successful at energizing his opponent's base. What do you think of that assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. And he hasn't tried to. He hasn't attempted to expand that base in the way a president usually would. When you have the power of the office, you tend to speak more across the whole nation rather than just gearing a message towards your own supporters. And since day one, it's been noticeable that he hasn't done that. Just the amount of time that's spent talking about the base is really unusual. There would usually be much more attention on independent voters, swing voters, you know, people who aren't committed to one party or the other. He's gone completely deep on this strategy of maximizing his base, which could work. It creates a very narrow path, though, because you need to get so many of them out to vote, and you've got to have worries about those people in the middle, suburban voters, college-educated white people, even who would be traditional Republicans and may have voted for him last time. They're not the people that he's appealing to with some of his messages. So that's the really risky thing about his strategy.
Now, it seems to me that he's been attempting a kind of rhetorical pivot over time. I mean, he was very successful with branding Hillary Clinton Crooked Hillary in 2016. When I say very successful, I mean it energized his base, as we've just been talking about. He still didn't get as many votes as Hillary Clinton, but he got the Electoral College votes that he needed. He's been trying the same thing for months now with Joe Biden, referring to him as Sleepy Joe Biden, which is presumably a reference to Biden's lower profile, the fact that he's seen as perhaps their own polling shows this up, that he's not seen as energetic, sort of vibrant and present as Trump is, as the president is. It's trying to play on the idea that Joe Biden is too old to be seeking the office. There's been a bit of a pivot in this even in recent times, though, as I understand it, where now the Republicans are starting to, and Trump, the Trump administration are starting to, they're dropping that and moving to a new strategy of talking about the people Joe Biden is surrounded by, that if you're electing Joe Biden, you're actually electing a radical left cabal, that Biden is some sort of Trojan horse for the left-wing radicals that have been on the streets in American cities and that, you know, parading cancel culture and all these other extremes. Is that your reading of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And what it paints, what it points to is the strangely tough task they're having with Joe Biden, who in some ways is an unimpressive candidate in some ways. I mean, when I saw him in Iowa at the start of this year at the Iowa caucuses and whatnot, his speeches were terrible, you know, just so flat, almost no one there. He wasn't generating any excitement. And that was the time where it looked like he wasn't going to win the nomination because Democrats thought he was a figure from the past. You know, he's not a very exciting campaigner right now. There's little enthusiasm about him in the way you would expect. Like Washington, D.C., where I live, is a very, very Democratic city. So is New York, where I've been a bit. I haven't seen one single Joe Biden sign in anybody's house or, you know, any. There's no sign that anyone's excited about him. But for people, he's a comforting figure and he's not a scary figure who's easy to caricature like Bernie Sanders would have been. And that what you're getting at there with this puppet of the left is Donald Trump's dream was to run on the strength of the economy that he was going to say he delivered. Well, that's been destroyed right now by the coronavirus. And two, he was hoping to run against Bernie Sanders, who is a self-declared a socialist, you know, and painted as a socialist takeover of America. So he's trying to do that with Joe Biden, but it's not working so far because that is just not the image most people have of Joe Biden. He's a very well-known figure from his years in the Senate and then as Obama's VP. So he's been hard for them to attack. They've tried all different types of things. They're trying to say he's a puppet of China and that he's soft on China. They're saying very explicit things that he has dementia and Alzheimer's, which there isn't evidence for. But sometimes with Trump, his heart doesn't even seem to be in it. He'll say things like, oh, well, Biden is an extreme, but some of the people around him are extreme. You know, Trump doesn't seem to have it in him to attack him in the same way that he did with Hillary Clinton. So that's the thing about Biden. In one way, he's a very formidable candidate, and in another way, he's not a very impressive one, and they're finding that hard to deal with.
Yes, one wonders whether that's just what the American voters want, though, is just a return to orthodoxy, a return to some sort of normality and predictability, even if it isn't very exciting.
That's what his team would say in defense. You know, Trump's team will point to things like Biden's YouTube rallies, virtual rallies that he's hosting during this pandemic are only getting a few thousand views, and isn't that terrible? Look how many more Trumps get. Well, and what Biden supporters would say, well, most people don't want to tune in or need to tune in because they have faith that he's going to be competent and normal and saying the things you'd expect a president to say so they can tune out and think about something else. And that's a comforting thought for people right now when there's so much uncertainty in the world.
And what about Biden's running mate? Because a lot of this is connected. A lot of this framing of Biden is connected with this issue of who his running mate will be as a potential, you know, VP should he win. Who is that going to be, and does that play into that narrative that Trump's trying to establish that in fact Biden is merely a, you know, a stalking horse, that he's only going to be there. He may not even see out the first term, let alone serve two terms.
Yeah, I think the Trump team would be loving him to pick someone controversial or someone quite out there as his VP. For example, Elizabeth Warren, who ran against Biden in the nomination process. She is someone who, for Trump and the people of Fox News, is just a figure they could really attack as this Harvard professor with all these ideas about reshaping America. She's someone who gets under the skin of conservatives and excites them to come out and vote. So the feeling is that Biden isn't going to do that, that he's going to try to avoid being too risky here. There's a lot of conditions going around this choice. He said in March, I think, you know, he said, I'm going to nominate a woman as my choice. So that knocked out a lot of people and narrowed the field quite a lot. And then with the Black Lives Matter movement and the process, a lot of momentum has built around the idea that he should pick not just a non-white woman, but that he should pick a Black woman to try and harness the energy of this discussion around racial justice and to fire up Black voters. So that narrows the field even further. So
who are the possibilities here? Kamala Harris is one.
Kamala Harris is the main one, and it's one of those things where there's a feeling of inevitability around her, which is strange in some ways because she actually had the most contentious moments with Biden on the debate stage. She went after him very, very obviously. People are debating; it's normal to attack each other in some way, but she went after him in a quite personal way, really, around school integration, you know, between Black and white school children. And then she dropped out of the race very early before Iowa because her campaign was going terribly and she wasn't attracting any support, including from Black voters who were going for Joe Biden. She's from California, which is already a safe state, so she's not necessarily going to bring any votes for a particular region. So that would be an interesting thing about her if she's nominated. Yeah, it's unclear exactly what Biden's trying to do, or if he's just going to try and pick the woman that he'd get along with best. The fact it's taking a bit longer than we'd expected is suggesting that he's finding it hard to land on the perfect person who's ticking the right boxes of someone he likes and gets along with, but someone who's going to not upset his election chances or do him some good at the election. There's no perfect candidate out there.
Yes, I read somewhere that one of the things that might be holding it up is just the assessment that Biden and his strategists are making that things are going so well for him with the low profile and essentially not having any major announcements that why upset that? Why not just let that run for a bit longer before changing the dynamic as you would by introducing a VP candidate, particularly if it's someone who's controversial in their own right. So that'll be interesting to see. What just before we go, Matthew, what should we look for now in terms of the next big sort of signposts towards this election? I guess that might be the acceptance of nominations on both sides, which, as I understand it, are likely to both be done remotely.
Yeah, which is just a sign of how much the pandemic is reshaping this whole election. The conventions would be such a big, glitzy event packed with so many people. Biden's going to be doing it from his home in Delaware, accepting the nomination, and Trump is trying to figure out where he can give his. He's talking about the White House, which would be very, very unconventional to use the White House for such a party political event. That's a big moment in the process. The debate's already generating a lot of discussion. Some of Joe Biden's supporters are saying that he shouldn't debate Trump because he's just going to be met with a blizzard of lies and inaccurate statements. I think there will be debates, but they're going to be watched closely as well because Trump is putting quite a bit of a stock on using that as a chance to show that, you know, Biden isn't as mentally agile as he used to be. So they're going to get a lot of attention this time around as well. And I think, yeah, just to keep an eye, particularly this year, on, I'm going to be keeping an eye on the mechanics of voting, you know, how people are voting, you know, is the vote being suppressed in any way? Yeah, that just the mechanics of the system and whether people are participating is something to really watch, because it's never been done before to vote in a situation like this.
Well, Matthew, I'm very glad that we have you over there and we can read your coverage of US politics in the Nine newspapers, particularly. Anyone who can survive a five-story plunge onto the footpath or onto the concrete, I think, is tough enough to handle what the American political system is going to dish up, and we'll be watching it with great interest. Thanks so much for joining us today on Democracy Sausage.
Thanks a lot, Mark. It was a pleasure.
Look forward to talking to you again at a later date. And that's your lot this week for Democracy Sausage Extra. We'll be with you early next week with another Democracy Sausage. Until then, bye for now.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.